There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We are here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day and to do so in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? I think we got to face it. People don't need just another piece of our mind or another opinion piece, but they do very much need the very piece of the mind of Christ. So how are we going to be prepared to give that to them? We have resources posted for you for free at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you could sign up for our email newsletter, and we will send information out to you that I just don't have time to cover here on the air. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. All right, we are following a developing story today in the texting suicide case of Michelle Carter. You will remember, if you are a regular listener to The Reconnect, that this is the case in Massachusetts, a 17-year-old girl over text messages and then conversations over a period of time compelled her then boyfriend to kill himself. And so this, she has been convicted of involuntary manslaughter in the suicide of Conrad Roy III. And today she is facing the judge related to sentencing. She faces up to 20 years. Nobody really expects that she's going to get 20 years. But I do think that when we consider what our kids are doing today, I mean, some of the breaking news on CNN right now is that suicide rates among older girls in the United States, older teenagers, reached a 40-year high in 2015. And so when we think about these issues and we think about the fact that this age group of people is binge-watching things like 13 Reasons Why, which is a glamorization of suicide on Netflix, we have to be prepared to have these conversations with our kids. We have to be engaged. We cannot assume that they, you know what, they're competent enough to raise themselves once they've gotten to 16 or 17 years old. That is simply not true. That kid is not fully baked. They are not an adult, and you are still responsible for them. And they do not know how to behave. They certainly don't know how to behave on social media, and they don't know the value of human life. They just don't. And so you as an adult, if you're listening today, I want to encourage you to be praying for these two families. You know, there's no question that both sets of these parents and the siblings of these two young people and their friends and the local school, I mean, on and on and on and on, we need to be praying for the people involved in this story. And we've got to be talking with our kids about social media, and we got to be talking with our kids about the ways in which they engage with others, the value of their own life, and the value of the lives of others. If you were to read articles related to this case, I'm reading here one from Ray Sanchez at CNN, you're going to recognize that this young woman at the age of 17, you know, there's no question that she encouraged this young man to kill himself. And her actions are, you know, described as despicable conduct. And they're talking about not only, you know, what kind of sentence should she get in terms of the blame that she bears for the death of another human being, but in terms of creating a deterrent of some kind for other teenagers to do similar things. So it's an interesting conversation. 40 states actually have laws that make it a crime to coerce or encourage suicide. Massachusetts is not among those states. And so one of the things that people expect as an outcome of this case in Massachusetts is that Massachusetts would look at the development of laws that would, in the future, curb this kind of behavior, at least by making it illegal. This is an interesting paragraph that I wanted to share with you from this Sanchez piece. He says, the court has found that Carter's actions and failure to act, where it was her self-created duty to Roy, since she's the one who put him in the toxic environment, that's what constituted the reckless conduct. And that's the conduct that the court found that caused the death of Mr. Roy. I found it very interesting that it was listed as Carter's actions and her failure to act. Friends, those are sins of commission, things that we actually do that are wrong, and sins of omission, failing to do all the good we might have done in a particular circumstance. So, you know, not only is it wrong to encourage or coerce someone to take their own life, it's equally wrong when you hear them dying to not say, get out of the truck, call 911, and tell them where this person in distress is. So there's lots of fodder here in the Sanchez piece on CNN. It's entitled Texting Suicide Case. Michelle Carter faces 20 years at sentencing. If you wanted to print something out and have a conversation with your teenagers about something going on in the news where you're really going to have an opportunity to draw them into a very serious conversation about right and wrong behavior, not only at the personal and interpersonal level, but on social media in terms of texting as well. So there you go. That's my bold encouragement to you today to get in there into conversation with your kids. All right, the next subject matter is related to the sanctity of marriage. These issues in our culture keep circling around, right? So, so we could be talking about the sanctity of marriage and we could be having a conversation about the acceptance in our culture of no-fault divorce. We'd be having that conversation a generation ago. A couple of years ago, we would be having the conversation about the growing acceptance and then the legalization of same-sex marriage. Well, now we are having the next conversation in our culture because, you know, once you start down this path, not only of the redefinition of something that, frankly, God alone is in a position to define, but once you start down a path of redefinition, once you have said that the feelings of the people involved is the only thing that matters and that there's no actual substance to marriage beyond some kind of emotional feeling between people, then you cannot stop at the number two. All right. We were headed toward this finding. The moral acceptance of polygamy reaches a record high. Now, you're going to say, as soon as I tell you that this Gallup study has revealed that 17% of Americans find polygamy morally acceptable, you're going to say 17%, that's just not very many people. Hey, 17% of your neighbors and my neighbors think polygamy, multiple marriage, thruples, combinations of men and women beyond the number two in a marriage is morally acceptable. Okay, you have to be concerned when we start talking about not just the gross number of people that 17% of the U.S. population represents, but the trend line. What we're talking here is about a trend line. So these results come from Gallup's Values and Beliefs poll, which was done across the country May 3rd to 7th of this year. And there's been a growing acceptance of polygamy over the past 15 years. Again, we're talking about that trend line. And polygamy is defined as having multiple spouses at one time. Now, it still remains one of the most morally taboo social behaviors in the eyes of Americans. Again, we're talking about 17%, a level of acceptance of 17%. But that is up from 7% in 2003 who said it was morally acceptable. So in 2003, 7% of Americans thought polygamy, multiple marriage, was acceptable. And now 17% do. That is a trend line to which we must pay attention. So over the past 5 years, this article on Gallup says, the percentage of Americans who think polygamy is morally acceptable has been edging up. All right. So 1 in 10 Americans in 2012 to now just under 1 in 5 Americans. So I want you to think about that for a minute. You got 5 people standing around. Do not assume that all 5 of you agree that polygamy is wrong, morally wrong. One of those people likely thinks, even in the back of their mind, and they're willing to say to a pollster, you know what, if two guys getting married or two girls getting married is okay, then, you know, I don't really see an issue in 3 girls getting married or 1 guy and 2 girls. Like, where's the barrier? If there's no actual barrier created or definition or boundary set by something that is morally immovable, right, unshakable, something like God, is what I'm trying to get at here. If you don't have that kind of moral anchor, then the definitions of these terms will simply move in the direction of the feelings of people in the culture. And people are having amorous feelings toward lots of people. Okay, so this observation here says social liberalism offers no compelling grounds for limiting the number of people who might wish to marry one another. So polygamy remains illegal in all 50 states, and yet there is an active challenge to that, at least in Massachusetts, where three women, Doll, Kitten, and Bryn, all participated in, they are engaged in a polyamorous relationship. They have together a child, thanks to a sperm donor. And they are in what they understand to be a polyamorous union. They held what looked for all the world like a wedding. They all wore white dresses, and their three dads walked them down the aisle to, quote unquote, wed one another. They are fighting for legal status as a throuple in the United States. What is the logical barrier to that? Now that in the Obergefell decision of the Supreme Court in June of 2015, we have removed the barrier. And you say to yourself, well, you know, it's still illegal in all 50 states, so we're really not headed in this direction. I got to tell you, once 17% of Americans agree on something, we are headed in a direction, especially if the trend line is, since 2003, up from 7%. That is a trend line that is moving in a direction for a reason and by some kind of influence. And it's not just gay marriage. I would contend it's also television, which is one of the things that the Gallup study actually takes time to recognize. It says one way Americans may feel more familiar or sympathetic to polygamy is through television. In 2010, a Learning Channel, which it's curious that it's on the Learning Channel, which is TLC, began airing a show called Sister Wives. And the way that Gallup describes it is actually from the Washington Post. It humanized a family of polygamists. The show was successful and remains on the air today, according to this article. And you say to yourself, hey, Christians do not buy this. We've got to be talking here about something that's going on in a part of the culture that's not influenced by Christians. Okay, so this is where, to my listeners, I'm going to say, hello, you're the Christians that are out there in the culture. If you know people who are engaged in polyamorous relationships, if you know people who buy into these cultural trends, if you know somebody watching Sister Wives and becoming sympathetic to the ideas, remember back to Will and Grace. Do you remember the show Will and Grace? That is when the United States of America began marching culturally toward a normalization and acceptance of the gay lifestyle. And it was called Will and Grace for a reason. Sister Wives is called Sister Wives for a reason. Okay, they're playing on theological ideas and theological parameters. Will and grace, are certainly theological terms. Okay, so here you go. In the Gallup study, and I'll conclude this portion of the lecture with this. Sorry if you feel like you're being lectured to today. 32% of Americans who do not associate with a particular religion or have no religion at all say polygamy is morally acceptable. So when we start talking about the percentage of the population that is unaffiliated, which we all know is a growing percentage of the population, when we're talking about that group of people, one in three of them think polygamy is okay. So not surprisingly, because this follows what Gallup recognizes as the general tendency for those who are less religious to be more liberal on social issues. I would say it's not even liberal, it's morally flexible. They are endlessly morally flexible. When it comes to these kinds of things. Now, again, I would also say, not surprisingly, Americans who identify with a Christian religion are less likely than the overall population to find polygamy morally tolerable. All right, friends. So polygamy is on the rise in terms of acceptance, moral acceptance among Americans. I'm going to have to leave it right there because I really do want to talk with you today about this school case as well. All right. So you might recall, you know, once I get like on a thought process, I feel like I need to unpack it with you. So here we go. So from the Obergefell decision of the Supreme Court, I started thinking to myself, well, what else has the Supreme Court decided lately that might have implications beyond that which the ruling actually covered? And I thought to myself, hey, that Trinity Lutheran case. Remember that Trinity Lutheran case? Remember, it was about a playground, about whether or not the playground on the campus of a preschool at a church could not only apply for but receive the same kind of crushed up tires to cover their playground as secular preschools, right? Do the kids at a preschool that is located on the campus of a church, you know, do they deserve the same kind of ground up tires on their playground as kids playing on the public playground down the street? Okay, so in the Trinity Lutheran versus Comer case, you might remember that the Supreme Court ruled that churches cannot be excluded from public benefits simply because they are religious. So let's think about that for a moment. The court ruled that the church could not be blocked, the church daycare could not be blocked from receiving generally available state funding. And it was unconstitutional that the church did not get the same, you know, essentially playground equipment, covering for the playground, that other people were getting. Here is what one legal scholar is saying about how that opens the door for, you know, things beyond the playground. All right, so here you go. Trinity Lutheran opens the door because it states simply that if a religious entity is otherwise qualified to take part in a public benefit program, then it cannot be prohibited solely on the basis of its religious affiliation. So what are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about charter schools. Talking about charter schools. So that is the article that I want to lift up to you today from The Atlantic. Will churches ever be allowed to run charter schools? You might be saying to yourself, hey, I'm actually surprised churches aren't already running charter schools. Okay, so here's the deal. Charter schools are overseen, or maybe that's the wrong word. The government actually authorizes charter schools and pays a stipend to charter schools, pays for kids to be educated at charter schools, right? You can take your voucher and use it at a charter school. In many states, you cannot take that same voucher and use it at an expressly religious school. Now, in some places you can. So I realize that this is not true across the board. Vouchers are different in different states. So the article here in The Atlantic begins to stir up the conversation. And again, this Trinity Lutheran case is understood to open the door of conversation related to this. Here are the things that I felt like the Atlantic article might have gotten to more quickly than it did. The impact and the conversation that we need to be having here is not just related to Christian schools. It's not just related to Jewish schools. It's related to schools that will be run by the Islamic centers across the country. Okay? And when we start talking about whether or not your church or your synagogue or your mosque is going to be allowed to be funded by the government to run a school, the very next question is, can they sufficiently limit themselves from teaching their religion? Because that's really ultimately the line of division that would have to be walked here. Okay, playing on a playground is not a religious activity. And it's difficult to religiously influence what's happening on a playground. I don't know about you, but that's just, you know, the playground is the playground. Once you get inside that school building or that church building, now functioning as a school, now functioning as a charter school, and you say, hey, they should be able to have access to the same kind of government funding and the benefit that anybody else should have, now you're talking about the content of what is taught. And so in this article, I actually found it really interesting. They say things like, just because it's a religiously affiliated charter school doesn't mean it's going to teach a particular religion. Now, is that true? Just because it's religiously affiliated doesn't mean it's going to teach a particular religion. It says that I think it makes it much easier for churches now to argue that charter schools in churches should be eligible for government support for the secular side of their mission. How in a church do you distinguish a secular side of a mission? Okay, so this actually, I feel like, buys into the false dichotomy of the secular and the sacred. I got to tell you, if you've got a school on your church campus and it's not a Christian school, what in the world are you doing? And the same would be true. If you are a synagogue and you have a school on your campus and you're not teaching the Jewish faith, what are you doing? I have a very hard time imagining that a school on the campus of a mosque run by an Islamic center is going to restrain itself and only teach a secular curriculum not influenced in any way by the Islamic faith. Now, and you'll say, well, that's just my bias showing. No, that's actually a legal ruling in 2008 showing where the Tariq Ibn Zayed Academy, a school, a charter school in Minnesota, located on the campus of a mosque, during which children were required to fast during Ramadan. The cafeteria served only halal food. Vacations took place during Muslim holidays only. Students had to avoid stepping on carpeted prayer areas in the school's center as they walked to class. And classes broke every afternoon for prayers at the specific time of the call to prayer. And almost all students participated, although the school did not officially conduct the prayer times. So if you don't think it's happening, it's very, very difficult to bifurcate religious activity from what's happening in a school setting if the school setting is on a church campus. So I don't know where all of this is going to end up. I'm telling you that the conversation is coming. The conversation is happening across the country. Be prepared to engage in it. We do have resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com on the subject matter of school choice and education in general. And so I would encourage you to take advantage of those resources as they might be helpful in equipping you for the conversations of the day. Hey, yesterday we talked with Andrew Walker about the transgender movement and the Christian response to it. Today, I think we got to consider this is like in the headline news every single day. Glenn Beck actually had a gentleman on his program this week. This is a person who was born genetically male, transitioned fully, surgery and otherwise, to living as a female, then came to himself, much like I imagine the prodigal son came to himself. This man came to himself and now is living again as a man, but without the benefit of the anatomy with which he was born because it has been surgically altered. Okay, this kind of story we are going to encounter more and more and more. And it's not, as Christians, we have to be prepared to receive this person and speak the redemptive truth into their life in much the same way that Philip spoke the redemptive truth of God's grace into the life of the Ethiopian eunuch as he ran alongside that chariot that on that one day for that divine appointment. So I want you to think about that. I want you to think about, people who are made eunuchs for all kinds of reasons and how it is that we speak the gospel into their lives. We got to know the Bible and it's got to be woven into the warp and woof, not only of our hearts and minds, but into our conversations. We have to be prepared to talk. Okay, so as if on cue, we have another story in the news today. This time, an 8-year-old boy who wants his school, a private school, by the way, to treat him like a girl and is therefore suing this, quote, conservative or traditional school and its parent company in California. Folks, everyone is being asked to participate in a culture-wide delusion related to transgenderism. These are conversations for which we must be prepared. I would encourage you to go and listen to my conversation with Andrew Walker that we had yesterday here on the Reconnect. If you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, it's really easy to find because it's the last show posted. It's yesterday's show. So there you go. Hey, the Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. So we would appreciate it if you took a minute to visit us at reconnectwithcarmen.com and click on that Donate Now button. We can only keep doing this and we can only keep doing this in more and more places if you join us in this ministry. So if you find what we do here helpful and you think it might be helpful to others, we'd like to ask you to help us stay on the air. So go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and join us today as a reconnector. All right, be praying for us. We're going to be praying for you. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com and we'll be right back. Friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. Indeed, there is power, power in the name of Jesus, and we're here to exalt the name of Jesus Christ, not only above all others, but in a culture where everybody encourages us to make a name for ourselves. So how do we make the name of Jesus great in the culture today? How do we have the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? How do we influence the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus? That's what we're seeking to equip you to do here on The Reconnect. Equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And if you'd like a little help with that, we have resources that we have developed for you. They are available for free at reconnectwithcarmen.com. So you just go to the website, reconnectwithcarmen.com, take what you want. If you're in a position to help us in terms of the furtherance of the ministry, we always appreciate that kind of support as well. All right. Hey, we have been talking here on The Reconnect about issues related to identity. Yesterday, we had a lengthy conversation with Andrew Walker on the subject of the transgender revolution in America and what the Bible has to say about the subject of identity. And today we're going to really kind of continue on a similar theme. We're going to have a conversation with Ashley McGuire. Ashley writes and speaks widely about religious freedom, Catholicism, and women. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, USA Today, Time Magazine. She's a recipient of the Susan B. Anthony Liss Young Pro-Life Leader Award. She's a founding editor at Alt Femme, which is a web magazine devoted to the exploration of faith and gender in, by the way, my listeners will want to know, a positive way. She is the author of Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Ashley McGuire, welcome to The Reconnect.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so our goal here is to, you know, speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So we're going to invite you to speak the truth about sex and gender. What are the definitions of those terms and the difference between the terms sex and gender?
Well, I think this is really important because what I discovered in my research for my book was that people really confuse and conflate these terms. And I've done a lot of interviews on the book, and I've basically boiled it down to this. Sex means something, gender means nothing. What do I mean by that? If you were to consult the medical industry, whether you were to ask a doctor or a scientist or a researcher what sex means, they would give you a very clear-cut definition. It means male or female, as determined by your chromosomes and your genitalia. The end. If you were to ask somebody what gender means, they would give you one of literally infinite definitions. In fact, people really can't even define what that means anymore. And so, unfortunately, people are conflating the terms, and what we're seeing now is a world where people, I think, are trying to replace the concept of sex with gender. In other words, treat sex like it is something with infinite possibilities, when in fact we know it's really not, and that it's pretty clear-cut and very much tied to science.
So for the benefit of my listeners, let me just remind folks that you have heard in the culture people describe, you know, hey, when a baby is born and we declare, hey, it's a boy or it's a girl, you have heard in our culture that folks regard that now as us arbitrarily assigning a gender at birth. We're not arbitrarily assigning a gender at birth. And then that leads to the conversation, though, about gender reassignment surgery, which now is called gender confirmation surgery. And so what Ashley is lifting up here is confirmed in the culture, like the language of gender replacing the language of biological chromosomal sex, male and female. She's exactly right. And so I want you to be looking for it and listening for it in the conversations of the day and calling it out when you hear it. All right. So Ashley, tell us why abolishing gender is a bad idea.
Well, what I would say is it's abolishing sex. That's what the culture is trying to do. And really, it's really sort of a small elite segment of society that's pushing this. I think if you were to go around and talk to most everyday Americans, they would, you know, easily agree with you that men and women are different. In fact, it's something they'd probably say with a laugh. And that those differences are pretty fixed. You know, we could talk about, for example, the reproductive differences between men and women, the bodily differences between men and women. And what's amazing is as science progresses, we're finding out more and more just how different we are, how different our brains are, how different our hormones are, how those differences interplay with each other for the better. So it's sort of a funny irony of what's going on is that you have science on the one hand confirming, yes, we're very different. In fact, we're more different than we ever could have possibly imagined. And then you have society saying there's no difference or the differences are immutable or can be overcome. When we know that's not really true. In fact, I was stunned when I read a study, a Mayo Clinic study. So Mayo Clinic is considered sort of the premier medical hospital institution in the country. And they defined sex as something that stays with you from womb to tomb. Those were their words.
Well, and yet so I would give a little cultural pushback. And this is where every day on the show, what we're trying to really equip our listeners to do is, okay, they're reading in the paper about this, you know, the headline is man in Oregon gives birth to son. Now, that's not possible. There's nothing about that headline that aligns with reality. And yet that is the cultural delusion that we're all being invited to participate in. And we're being invited to participate in it, when kids, you know, are declaring that they are, you know, not boys, but they are girls and they want to wear the girls' uniform and use the girls' bathroom at school. And we're raising kids right alongside them who've got to go to that same, you know, third grade classroom. So can you help equip us how to speak the truth into those very real cultural situations where folks are actually demanding that we participate in their delusion?
Well, yeah. And, you know, I would go back to the example of this story that's going around about a quote-unquote man who gave birth and say, especially women, do we want to really let men take credit for something so difficult and so extraordinary that only we can do? I mean, I've done it 3 times now. I just did it a few months ago. And the idea that men would start taking credit for even that, I find it to be sort of, again, another irony of our sort of feminist culture that we supposedly live in, that women are actually sort of giving up what authentic womanhood is to this movement that does not have the interests of women at hand. And so this is an argument that I really push in the book, is I think one way to really push back is to focus on the harms to women. We are the ones who have the most to lose in a society that denies the differences between the sexes. We are the most reproductively vulnerable. We go through things that men never will and cannot, and that makes us need society to recognize that about us, to respect it, and to really praise it. Otherwise, we get kind of sucked into this, you know, every man for himself world. And, you know, you look back at, say, like Title IX, and this idea of prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex, not gender, sex. This was something women fought for. And are we now going to give that up because we don't even recognize sex as a category anymore? So I think that's one really powerful way to push back, is to focus on the harms to women, the harms to children who are, like women, vulnerable in certain ways. And another thing I think that's powerful is, you know, we live in this culture that's so obsessed with science. We just had the March for Science. Everybody's always talking about science. And to go back to the science on this and read up on, you know, every day I feel like I see a new article come out from the scientific community about sex differences and how, you know, we just a huge study came out from Stanford comparing the male and female brain. And finally, I think speaking about the differences between men and women in a positive way. You know, I think there's this idea we've gotten into our heads that the differences are somehow threatening, that it's a threat to equality that men and women are different, when in fact we should be celebrating what makes us different, that those differences really interplay with each other. And we're starting to understand really how much women bring to the table in society. We see, you know, companies that hire more women, they have a bigger bottom line. Men that have daughters, they pay their employees more. There's something about women and what makes us unique that makes society better, and we don't want to lose sight of that.
Oh, I think those are fantastic points. Friends, you're hearing Ashley McGuire. She's the author of Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. I'm so glad that you took us down this path, this you know, this harms to women path, because I do think that at least I observe a very serious disconnect in terms of high profile, you know, quote unquote feminists who are out there on the one hand, you know, arguing for choice in terms of reproductive rights. And I disagree with them on that front. But then they're mute. They're totally mute on, like, the Title IX issues related to, you know, when a transgender person who is biologically male is now, you know, beating our girls in sports because they can't compete. They're literally wired differently. And so I'm so glad that you raised this. The Title IX issue is an issue. I think, you know, we're getting excited in our culture about more and more girls being actively engaged in STEM, not just in academics, but in STEM careers, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And as soon as you say, you know, that sex doesn't matter and we're going to completely disregard that and we're not going to take that into account, I do think you're going to see women displaced in a lot of categories where they are just now beginning to emerge and find a foothold. So I also wonder if you're seeing anything in the area of arguments related to sexual harassment. Like, at some point, if there's no difference in men and women, and then how could there actually be any genuine harassment?
Well, that's another great point. I mean, you know, rape is considered a particularly heinous crime because it's a sex-based offense. It's a man using his physical advantage to take advantage of a woman who, because of her reproductive vulnerability, is in a really, really bad position. I mean, there's no differences between the sexes, then why isn't it just considered aggravated assault? And, you know, I give the example in the book of the pop artist Kesha, who had her rape case thrown out And the judge actually used really eerie language and said something to the effect of, not every rape is a gender-motivated hate crime, because one of the things she was arguing is that her boss, who was a man, really created a culture of sexual harassment and sort of used these sexualized women and took advantage of her. And that to me is sort of like, do we want to go down that path where, you know, and I give another example of a case of a domestic violence center. So these are women who are fleeing their rapists and their abusers, that was sued because they would not allow a biological man who self-identified as a woman to enter. And you're now seeing different states where they're actually allowing, you know, biological men to be housed with women in homeless shelters, things like that. And I think the safety issue for women is a huge, huge concern, not just bathrooms. I think people are overly focused on bathrooms. I mean, yes, that's a problem, but there is a much bigger sort of Pandora's box that we're opening. What about summer camps? You know, are people going to feel safe sending their 10-year-old girls to summer camps if we stop? I mean, look at the Boy Scouts. Girl Scouts, a long time ago, to my shock, decided that they would allow biological males to participate, and now Boy Scouts have done the same. So suddenly we're talking about underage girls in sleepovers with adult males and pubescent teenage boys. And then we're going to be surprised when we start hearing sexual assaults happening. I mean, look at what's happening in college campuses. If you want to see where this issue is going, I think look at college campuses. They're about 10 to 15 years ahead of us. They have a sexual assault crisis, pandemic. The most likely place a woman overwhelmingly is likely to be assaulted is in a dorm. Why? Because something like 90-some percent of dorms are co-ed, and many of them have co-ed bathrooms. You have men and women walking around in their towels in front of each other, because all of this is born out of this idea that, oh, they're not really that different. We can house them together. I mean, what's the big deal? Suddenly you have a rape crisis going on, and, you know, college students can get in trouble if they don't use the right pronoun, even when it's grammatically incorrect. So I think the safety issue is a huge thing, and again, is another really sort of powerful way to push back and say, well, what about the safety of women in a culture where we're increasingly not even acknowledging woman as a fixed and finite legal category?
All right, Ashley, you're scaring us, but we got to get motivated by something. So, all right, friends, she is Ashley McGuire. The book is Sex Scandal: The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. You should also check out Alt Femme, which is a web magazine devoted to the exploration of faith and gender, or actually faith and sex, I suspect. All right, Ashley, thank you for joining us today on the Reconnect. We look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you.
All right, friends, she got another book coming out this fall, so I'm pretty sure we're going to get to talk to her again about what she's working on next. Okay, but at this point in the show, we got to go below the fold. We're going to lift up a story and make a connection that's designed to help you start and engage with other people in conversations that may not appear at first to be about Jesus. In fact, this story is about really, really hot asphalt. So out in the West, we are having, a heat wave of kind of significant proportions. Like, I don't know, it's like 102 in Portland. That's just crazy hot for that part of the country. Well, you can imagine that down in Arizona, it is hot. Sometimes it gets so hot in Arizona, the asphalt begins to get smushy. It actually begins to melt a little bit. So this story takes place on the scorching hot asphalt of Arizona. David Lee Witherspoon Jr. is a food pantry volunteer at St. Vincent de Paul. He saw a homeless man literally crawling across the hot asphalt on all fours, because the man didn't have any shoes. He had taken his socks off. He had put them on his hands so he wouldn't burn his hands as he crawled across the street on all fours. And this man, David Lee Witherspoon Jr., he was prepared both by prayer and both by thinking in advance, and then in terms of actually having physically what was needed to respond in a way that changed this man's life. And so that's what I want to talk about. When I read you the rest of this story, I want you to ask yourself, am I actually prepared in advance to respond like this when I see another human being in this kind of crisis. So the article says, Witherspoon washed the homeless man's feet with a bottle of water from his car. He gently dried them, and then he put shoes on his feet. He says, I switch out my shoes often, so I always have an extra pair in the car. And then he went on to say, look, you don't have to empty your wallet or anything even like that. It's just a kind act. I want to ask us today, I want to ask you today about your own personal prayer, care, share lifestyle. Because I think so often we want to share the gospel with other people. We want to articulate it. We want to talk about it. But we are not actively praying in advance for every and any divine opportunity or appointment that God might set. We're not preparing ourselves to respond. We're literally not. We're not thinking ahead. How would I respond if I saw a person today in this kind of situation? We're not reading the news and saying to ourselves, what would I do? What would I do? And then actually physically putting together the resources that would be necessary to respond. So here's what I'm asking in relationship to this kind of a story. Have you prayed in advance to respond as the Good Samaritan responded? Are you actually, have you prayed in advance to be a person of mercy? That God would have you, have your heart in such a place that you would not be in such a hurry on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, that you would not be in such a hurry to get to whatever important meeting it is that you're headed to, that you really couldn't be bothered by the time that it would take to stop and recognize the humanity of a person who is lying beaten and broken along the side of the road. Because most of us are just flat out in too great a hurry to stop and help. We're in too great a hurry to stop and help. So what does it mean to prayerfully prepare in advance to be a person of mercy? It means we intentionally create a margin of time in our schedule. We leave 5 minutes early every time for every appointment. We leave 5 minutes early. We leave 10 minutes early. All right, so I'm just going to use a quick example from my own life. And in fact, I was actually already late, or I thought I was going to be late, to the thing that I was going to. Because again, I hadn't prepared. It's not like a bridal shower comes up on you and like, you know, you're invited the hour before it happens. I mean, like I knew it. It was on the calendar. It was a bridal shower. It was an important bridal shower. I needed to be at it. Obviously, you know, you don't show up to a bridal shower without a gift. That's sort of the point of the whole thing. So I clearly had not gotten the gift in advance. And so I needed to get the gift on the way to the bridal shower. And I didn't even put enough margin in there. You know, you can't go to Bed Bath & Beyond and expect to get the gift off the registry and then get it wrapped and get in the car. I mean, that is it's a long process. So I had not really actually allowed enough time to get all of that done. But God is who He is. And God can multiply your time in ways that you would find shocking if you will just do and be obedient to what He has set before you to do. So I get to Bed Bath & Beyond. Of course, I don't actually have the registry yet. So then I pull it up on my phone, come to find out you can do that. And I go and I find an item and I check out and the guy directs me over to the place where you wrap it for yourself, which of course I couldn't match the box sizes. Anyway, it took me a whole lot longer than maybe it should have. And now I have this stack of boxes. I'm walking out. And as I'm walking to my car, I see these, it's hot, it's blistery hot in the middle of the summer where I live. And I see these two little old ladies. They've clearly just come from lunch because they have their little to-go boxes and they are standing behind this vehicle, this car in the handicap space. Now I cannot just walk past them. I can't, it's impossible. And so as I am walking past them, I say, are you ladies okay? And the one little old lady said, no. And I said, let me put my boxes in the car and I'll be right back. So I went, I put my boxes in my car and I came back. And assisting them required a few minutes of my time. How many minutes? I don't know. Because at that point, I'm just going to be late to the bridal shower. At that point, the people in front of me are going to receive the ministry of presence. They are going to receive the incarnational ministry of Jesus, whatever that looks like. And in this case, it looked like me being kind of bossy, to this guy in the parking lot who was all tatted up and standing next to this big truck, big pickup truck. And I wave to him, and he looks like I must be waving to someone else, because why would I, all dressed up for a bridal shower, by the way, be waving to a big tatted up guy in the parking lot? And I said, "Do you have jumper cables?" And he looked around as if maybe I might be asking someone else, and then he nodded yes. So I corral him from the other side of the parking lot. I get his truck in position in front of their little car and get him to get his jumper cables all hooked up. And we jump them off and we get them on their way. And I said, "Thank you so much to this young man." And he said, "Well, I didn't feel like I could tell you no." So I'm just encouraging you to just get out there and speak as one who has authority. When something needs to be done in the culture, you got to be prepared in advance to maybe boss people around a little bit. That would be maybe a little bit of my message here. I clearly did not have in my possession, in my trunk, what these little old ladies needed. But I was in a better position to get them the help that they needed than they were themselves. So sometimes it's just about you being an advocate for other people to get them what they need in their moment of need. Now, come to find out, I actually, because you know God is gracious, so gracious, I actually arrived at the bridal shower, you know, just in time. I was a little late, but you know, appropriately late. Okay, so now back to this guy who helped this homeless man in Arizona. Here is how he prepared for this. He had not only a bottle of water, but a towel in his trunk. And he keeps his extra shoes there. Like, the pair of shoes that are now retired, for whatever reason, are in his trunk. So, here's what I did after reading this article. I went through my closet. I found a pair of tennis shoes that I have not used in a fairly long period of time. They've been replaced by another pair of tennis shoes. I put a clean pair of socks in the shoe. And I took two bottles of water and a towel, and I put them in a bag in my trunk. I don't know that I will ever run across the situation that this gentleman ran into when he was in Arizona, but if I do, I'm now prepared. So I want you to ask yourself, what kind of event am I actually prepared to minister for Jesus in? What am I prepared to do? Think about it. Stick a bag in your trunk. It might be a bag of groceries. It might be a pair of shoes and a pair of socks. I don't know what it is, but my guess is you could go do it right now. Go prepare with the heart of Christ and the head of Christ to be the hands of Christ in the world today. Hey, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. Have a great day and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.